You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the Boulder Foothill News, read by Leslie Madsen. Today we'll be reading from the top three stories. Louisville, city works to clear backlog of records. Commercial area in Lafayette, historic World War I memorial pillars could move. And a former Lafayette top official, Sprague remembered for leadership, laughter, love of community, followed up by the reading of miscellaneous articles. City works to clear backlog of records. After months of staffing challenges amid vacancies in the city clerk's office, Louisville is making progress catching up on a months-long backlog of city council meeting records. A city spokesperson said Louisville will implement new technology in an effort in the works for over 2 years. This would help prevent future backlogs. The clerk's office is working toward being fully staffed, and creating and publishing our backlog of minutes is a priority, said Grace Johnson, Louisville City spokesperson. We are actively working on this. Minutes are the official written record of a public meeting that summarize the actions and sometimes the key discussions that took place. In the case of city council meetings, common practice is for the minutes to be recorded and the council to approve the minutes at the following meeting, according to Jeffrey Roberts, director of the Colorado Freedom of Information Coalition. The backlog rose to more than 50 sets of city council minutes awaiting completion, according to an August memo from the clerk's office. The backlog dates back to 2024, according to the memo. The backlog mounted following a series of staffing transition that began in mid-2024, Johnson said. In July of that year, the deputy city manager became the interim city manager, and the city clerk stepped into the interim deputy city manager role, but still performed some clerk's office work, according to Johnson. In February this year, a member of the clerk's office retired, and the next month, the interim deputy city manager, who had been the clerk, resigned to take a position with another municipality, according to Johnson. Between late March and mid-June this year, the two remaining people in the clerk's office were doing the work previously done by four people, Johnson said. A part-time staffer and a contract member were hired in the past few months, and interim city clerk Jenny Klein was hired into the permanent clerk position recently, according to Johnson. The city hopes that the clerk's office will be fully staffed by mid-November. The city council approved 8 sets of backlogged minutes at its 2 regular meetings in October, and another 9 sets were approved at the council's November 3rd meeting. State rule compliance. Louisville City Council meetings are broadcast on the city's website, Channel 8, and YouTube, and can also be watched at any time after a meeting is adjourned. The way that Louisville currently posts meeting videos allows users to click on any item in the meeting agenda and then jump to that corresponding point in the recording. That's a feature that is very helpful for transparency, according to Roberts. That might even be better than minutes, she added, because state law does not specify how detailed minutes must be, only that they're taken and made available for public inspection. Still, Roberts said that the city's backlog at one point reaching over 50 sets of minutes is pretty extreme. According to Johnson, Louisville defers to its home rule charter's language on minutes rather than Colorado's open meetings law. A home rule charter, essentially a local constitution, is a voter-approved document that gives a city or county the ability to act and legislate on local matters. In general, home rule ordinances addressing local matters supersede state law, but in matters of statewide concern, state laws may take precedence, according to an explainer document from the Legislative Council staff, the nonpartisan research arm for the state legislature. Without a home rule charter, local governments are strictly subject to the laws of the state, the explainer says. Louisville's charter does not include any language around a timeline for minutes to be created or approved, or whether they must be published online. The extent of a home rule charter's authority over meeting procedures has been tested before. Roberts pointed to a case in 2011 when a Larimer County District Court judge wrote that Loveland's home rule powers did not override state law. As demonstrated by the plain language of this provision, the legislature included a declaration with the intent of overriding any home rule powers of municipalities with respect to open meetings, the judge wrote, also noting that the legislature in 1991 amended the definition of local public bodies to specifically include home rule cities, according to a Colorado Freedom of Information Coalition article. However, because state district court rulings do not set precedents statewide, Robert said, the question remains unsettled. Appellate courts in Colorado have not ruled on whether a home rule city's charter can supersede or be less restrictive than the open meetings law, Robert said. Outdated state rule. Even Colorado's open meetings law does not mandate that minutes be published online, only that they be promptly recorded and made available to public inspection. Although, Robert said, many public bodies choose to post them anyway. The statute does not define what promptly means or set a timeline. With that said, Louisville's backlog of minutes does not explicitly violate its home rule charter or the state's rules, according to Roberts, but it does highlight some ambiguities in their language. I'm not aware of any case law interpreting what promptly means, Robert said, but I think that most people would say that a backlog of over 50 meetings going back to last year isn't promptly. Meeting minutes are one of those very basic documents that the community expects to be available on the city's website. Roberts called the state's rule outdated since it was created before the public came to expect easy online access to government records. He added that while parts of the law have been updated over time, the minutes provision is one of those things, I think, that could be updated. Requiring minutes to be posted within a more specific time frame could push local governments to make transparency more of a priority, Robert said. An August memo from the clerk's office explains that meeting minutes can generally take several forms. A word-for-word transcript, action summaries that capture only the decisions and conclusions made in a meeting, not the discussion. Summaries that include both decisions and details of the discussions that took place, which can vary in length and detail, from brief overviews to robust outlines of the discussions. To speed up the process of preparing minutes, Louisville switched in September to creating what it calls enhanced action minutes, according to Johnson. These include information for all agenda items, such as vote on approval of the agenda, council announcement, vote to adjourn, council direction, and other standard actions. She said enhanced action minutes are slightly more detailed than basic action summaries, but less detailed than the robust summaries that city staff had been creating before. The August memo notes that those robust summaries took about 4.5 hours to prepare for a typical 3.5 hour meeting. Meanwhile, staff are also working to launch a new agenda management system through Civic Plus, which Johnson said will streamline the preparation of agendas and minutes. The city has been working toward adopting an agenda management system for over 2 years to replace what Johnson called a very manual process for producing agendas, packets, meeting videos, etc. Implementation was paused during the search for a new city manager, but Johnson said final deployment could come in the first quarter of 2026. Commercial area in Lafayette. Historic World War I memorial pillars could move. Work is underway to potentially move the Road of Remembrance Gateway pillars. The World War I memorial pillars that flank Arapaho Road at the intersection of US 287, could finally have a new home after years of discussion. A plan is underway to relocate the two Road of Remembrance Gateway pillars to a parcel on the southwest corner of 95th Street and Arapaho Road on property tied to the Atlas Valley Commercial Area in Lafayette. The pillars built in the early 1990s serve as a memorial to those who served in World War I, according to a history document from the Boulder Rotary Club. In November 2021, the Colorado Department of Transportation determined the pillar's structural integrity had been compromised following major construction projects at the intersection. CDOT asked a mitigation working group made up of local historical groups and led by the Boulder Rotary Club to evaluate alternatives and gather public input. In 2023, the group recommended relocating the pillars to the northwest corner of Arapaho Road and US 287. But that plan fell through when no agreement could be reached with the property owner, according to Bill Meyer, a director at the Boulder Rotary Club. After reviewing numerous alternatives, Meyer said that the group selected the Atlas Valley location and submitted a revised recommendation to CDOT and the State Historic Preservation Office in February 2024. An earlier internal goal, moving the pillars by November 11, 2026, to coincide with Armistice Day, amid the country's 250th anniversary of independence, is unlikely, Meyer said. That date keeps slipping, and we've talked about that for 2 or 3 years, and now we're still a long ways away, so I'm pretty certain that date won't happen, he said. City and CDOT review still needed. According to Meyer, GVA Inc. is currently working on an engineering design for the site at Atlas Valley. The working group has also been in discussion with contractors about methods for removing and relocating the pillars. Stephen Williams, a planning and building director for the city of Lafayette, confirmed the city has been approached about the pillars potentially being relocated to private property in the Atlas Valley subdivision. For the pillars to be located there, Williams said that the city would need to review a proposed site plan and evaluate the impacts of the new location. A structural engineering plan would also be required, and the owner of Atlas Valley would need to be a party to the application for their property. The city has had some informal discussions about a location in Atlas Valley, but has not received a formal application, according to Williams, who added, "Our current understanding is that further technical review will be necessary to determine whether the proposed location, which is situated in a retention area and right-of-way, meets required engineering and safety standards." CDOT is also working closely with the Boulder Rotary Club, as well as other parties, to identify a suitable site, spokesperson Jared Field said. CDOT is aware that Atlas Valley is currently being evaluated. While approvals would come from the City of Lafayette, the working group will also be required to obtain CDOT permits for construction activity within the state right away. When we get the permit, we will approve their traffic control, their schedule, and a general methodology statement that would be related to motor safety. We will also collect an insurance certificate from the contractor at that time, Deal said. Future fundraising. Meyer said that the mitigation working group is waiting for engineering design work to be completed before it can begin fundraising for construction. The cost of that phase is not yet known, but he said that once designs are finished, they will be sent to construction firms for estimates on the foundation and relocation work. About $25,000 in private donations has already been raised to cover the design phase, Meyer said, although several donors have requested anonymity. Once the final site is confirmed and contributions from outside groups are known, CDOT will evaluate whether it can provide funding assistance, Fields said. A former Lafayette top official, Sprague remembered for leadership, laughter, and love of community. Fritz Sprague, who led Lafayette through an era that included the COVID pandemic and a city government cyber attack with what colleagues called fearless and compassionate leadership, died in October. Those who knew him remember a sharp dresser with a big laugh and a lifelong public servant who believed deeply in the communities that he served. Sprague served as the Lafayette City Administrator from 2019 until his retirement in May of 2023. Sprague, who passed away after a 3.5 battle with glioblastoma and malignant brain tumor, had a career in municipal government that spanned 3 decades in Colorado, Michigan, and Florida. Before arriving in Lafayette, he spent nearly 20 years working for the town of Castle Rock, including as deputy town manager. He also served as assistant to the city manager in Commerce City from 1993 to 1998. His dedication and passion for public service started early, said his husband, Scott Black. In Lafayette, the city administrator or city manager is essentially the chief executive officer of the city and is responsible for the day-to-day operations of city departments. Born in 1967 in Spokane, Washington, Sprague pushed his local leadership to pave the road in front of his family's home in his early years, Black recalled. He went on to earn both his undergraduate degree in political science and graduate degree in public administration from Eastern Washington University before beginning a lifelong career in public service. He took tons of leadership courses, Black said. He was just very dedicated to improving himself and making sure that he offered value wherever he was, Black said. He liked doing things and getting things accomplished. The nuts and bolts of city management. During his tenure in Lafayette, Sprague guided the city through turbulent years that included COVID-19 and a 2020 cyber attack that disabled city systems. Under his leadership, Lafayette avoided layoffs as the pandemic unfolded, and according to his retirement announcement from the city, he also enacted a declaration of a local disaster emergency following the cyber attack to allow for state and regional assistance. He knew how to put people in charge. He did not have to play the hero role. He was really good at finding out people's strengths and putting them in roles that were unconventional to maybe what their day job was, said Lafayette's current city administrator, Katie Dueling, who has served as deputy administrator under Sprague. During the pandemic, Dueling said, Sprague encouraged staff to adapt, even redeploying employees to mow parks or assist with other needs in order to avoid layoffs. Employees were really a priority. While maybe some other cities were laying people off, we were proud to pivot and keep everyone on through those tough months, she said. He should be remembered as a fearless and truly authentic person. The city credited Sprague upon his retirement for, quote, raising the bar, unquote, for city performance and championing training, education, equity, diversity, and inclusion. He supported local nonprofits such as Sister Carmen, along with several initiatives without Boulder County, the retirement announcement said. Sprague also helped secure major achievements for Lafayette, including the Global Settlement Agreement with Erie to manage the development along shared boundaries and the acquisition of Winnetka Centennial Farm, as well as bringing the Medtronic campus to Lafayette. That's a company among Boulder County's largest private sector employers, according to the city's retirement announcement. Heather Balser, who was Louisville city manager at the time of the Medtronic deal, was a longtime friend of Sprague. The two met through events for city management professionals years before either of them led their respective cities, she said, and they developed a strong friendship as they were able to compare notes on ideas and experiences. During the pandemic, we'd meet at McDonald's because we both liked their French fries, Balser recalled. When you could only go through the drive-thru, we'd sit there with our windows down and chat, just to get a breath of fresh air with a friend. When Medtronic's plans to develop a new campus shifted from Louisville to Lafayette, Balser said that Sprague made sure to call her personally to share the news. That's the way he was, I knew he would call and be professional about it and that someday we'd laugh about it. And we did, she said. He always had wonderful things to say. He was the sharpest dresser and he was a big laugher. He had this big, strong laugh. Balser described him as a lover of local government who brought innovation, spark, and effervescence to every role. You could hear it in the way that he spoke about the community and his purpose, she said. It's hard to imagine doing this work without him. Black said Sprague's commitment to Lafayette extended beyond his work. When we moved here, I was looking for a new doctor, and he said everything had to be in Lafayette. Your doctor, your dentist, and where you get your haircut. He was hardcore, Black recalled. Everything we did had to be Lafayette. Block said that they also enjoyed supporting local Lafayette spots. Among their favorites were Morning Glory Cafe, Tangerine, The Post, and Community Supper Club. Although Sprague was also a fantastic cook at home, Black added. Outside of work, Sprague was an avid traveler and scuba diver. His LinkedIn page reads, "Have passport, will travel. Cozumel, a small island off the eastern coast of Mexico, held a special place in Sprague's heart," Black said, and he achieved the level of rescue diver, training to manage dive emergencies and assist others. He embraced life, Black said. That was just Fritz. A celebration of life will be held at 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. on December 17th. That's Sprague's and Black's wedding anniversary at the Gatehouse within the Lion Gate Event Center at 1055 U.S. 287 in Lafayette. In lieu of flowers, the family requests donations to local nonprofits, including Sister Carmen, SPAN, and Rocky Mountain Equality, that reflects Sprague's dedication to community, Black said. Elder Care, Lafayette resident named Caregiver of the Year. For Lafayette resident Lynn Quintana, providing compassionate care to seniors means truly being involved in their lives. "They become family to me," said Quintana, who is 74 years of age. Thanks to her dedication to improving people's lives, she was recognized as the 2025 Caregiver of the Year by Seniors Helping Seniors. The organization pairs older adult caregivers with independent seniors seeking in-home care services and assistance with daily tasks. The Caregiver of the Year Award is handed out by the organization annually to a Seniors Helping Seniors employee who goes above and beyond in caring for their clients. Seniors Helping Seniors has around 200 locations worldwide, according to its webpage. Seniors Helping Seniors caregiver services include housekeeping, transportation, meal preparation, socialization, and help with daily routines. Quintana explained that spending time with clients in their homes means dealing with the unique needs of every individual. "Each client is different," she says. "I think the most important part of caregiving is getting to know the client and know what their needs are and what their wants are." Quintana works for Seniors Helping Seniors Boulder County, which employs roughly 50 caregivers who work around the county and in communities, including Broomfield and Brighton. Quintana joined the Boulder County team a couple of years ago, coming to the organization with over 3 decades of caring experience. "I wanted to do something that gave meaning to my life," Quintana said, recalling her first job in senior care. "Everything I give, I get back double fold." With almost 2 years under her belt at Seniors Helping Seniors, Quintana has already made a lasting impact on the Boulder County team by working with all kinds of clients, including seniors with Parkinson's disease and dementia. She also trains and mentors new caregivers. Sometimes her shifts start as early as 6 a.m. Quintana also modifies her schedule when needed to serve on weekends or stay with clients overnight. Colleen Elliott, who is owner of Seniors Helping Seniors Boulder County, nominated for Quintana for the award this year. Elliott said Quintana can put anyone at ease just by walking into the room. "She is a rock star," Elliott said. "She works at times with some of our really difficult scenarios. Nobody really throws her off, no matter how they are doing that day." Joseph Baker, one of Quintana's clients, is 83 and lives in the Longmont area. 3 days a week, Quintana spends quality time with Baker. She makes him lunch and trims his beard. They also take walks, watch movies, and talk about Baker's time in the military. When she first started, I was always sitting in my chair, Baker said. And then she just wouldn't let me sit there. She would get me involved in different stuff. Joanna McClure, Baker's daughter, said that her dad feels very cared for by Quintana. She's become a confidant for him, McClure said. She's become somebody that he trusts. She learns things from him, and of course he learns things from her. New union negotiates compensation plan. Boulder County's new employee union recently negotiated its first compensation agreement with the county, including increasing the annual base salary for full-time employees from $50,000 to $52,000. The lowest paid 10% of workers would also receive a 1% one-time bonus. Overall, the agreement would give all full-time employees a cost of living increase of $152 a month, an average increase of 2%. Bargaining committee member Katie Arrington, she works in the county administrator's office, said that she's proud the union was able to secure a bonus for the lowest paid workers. "We are really committed to equity and racial equity," she said. "That was a good step toward our goals. Most employees who earn a salary below the midpoint would receive an additional 2.7 standard increase, while most employees earning a salary at or above midpoint would receive a 2.2 standard increase. The standard increase applies to about 1,600 of the county's 2,900 employees. It does not apply to employees in offices led by separate elected officials, such as the district attorney's office. Sheriff office employees also negotiate a contract through a separate union. The total average salary increase will be 4.5%, according to county officials. "We've gotten to a really great place on compensation," said Commissioner Ashley Stoltzman at a recent commissioner's meeting on budget. The compensation agreement comes after contentious negotiating sessions that started in May. At a previous county commissioners meeting before the two sides reached an agreement on compensation, union members accused the county of refusing to negotiate in good faith. They pointed to the county hiring an outside lawyer to lead the negotiations and said the county was saying no to everything. The union was formed in January. Brianna Barber, a bargaining committee member who works in the commissioner's office, said during the meeting that employees expect severe cost of living pressures in the coming year. The $152 a month increase, she said, is inadequate to cover the extreme cost of living increases we anticipate. While the two sides reached an agreement on compensation, the union was continuing to negotiate an overall employment contract. Union members asked the county to give seasonal workers benefits and paid time off. They also want the county to move to a just cause employment model that they said would provide more worker protections, as well as to consider a 32-hour work week. "We are looking at the overall experience of all the workers," said bargaining committee member Martha Lugo, who works in Boulder County's Human Services Department. "We want to strive to make Boulder County the best employer to work for." Along with hearing the compensation agreement details, the Boulder County Commissioners recently signed off on most of the department budget requests. The commissioners were set to adopt the budget on December 9. The county general fund was especially limited this year, officials said, as the county makes cuts to address a deficit that will require identifying $30 to $40 million in savings over the next 3 years. In most cases, requests for additional employees were not considered. Instead, for the 2026 budget, the county had asked all of its department to identify staff savings. Altogether, the county was to eliminate 90 positions, including the laying off of 31 employees and cutting of about 60 vacant positions, all announced last September. Requests receiving approval included a $3 million increase in the Parks and Open Space acquisitions budget. Parks and Open Space plans to use revenue from its dedicated sales and use tax to make large upcoming planned land acquisitions, including CMEX's Dow Flats property. Also approved was the department's plan to spend $1 million for a fence needed for a proposal to bring a buffalo herd to Boulder County in conjunction with Native tribal leaders. From the general fund, the commissioners approved transferring $1 million to the Climate Equity Fund to cover the fund of projects starting in 2026. Another $1 million was transferred to the Climate Equity Fund from the Sustainability Sales Tax Fund. Not approved was a $2.9 million request to relocate the community justice staff from the Justice Center to a vacated detox facility and then renovate the community justice space for an additional courtroom. The county commissioners noted that an additional courtroom would only be needed if the state approves a request to add a judge. Other items not improved included the $325,000 request by the district attorney's office to hire a consultant to plan a family justice center, possibly in a leased space similar to the one that's offered in Jefferson County. The same request was made and not approved as part of last year's budget. Parks and Open Space did not receive funding for its request for two additional full-time rangers at about the cost of $100,000. Another denied request was for $1 million for paving and other approved improvements at the Parks and Open Space Shop facility in Longmont. Comments from the public received through an online form included urging the county to take care of its employees and community members in need. Others suggested the county allow more employees to work remotely to get rid of unnecessary buildings, set aside money for rental assistance, and provide more support to help residents access medical care and meet basic needs. It is essential that the budget include sufficient funds to support what could become a wave of homelessness in the next few years, one person commented. This will hit renters in apartments, rental houses, and mobile homes particularly hard. Museum of Boulder's Boulder Eats serves up the city's culinary history. When Christopher R. Taylor moved to Boulder last year to take the helm as executive director at the Museum of Boulder, he didn't expect to find the city's soul hidden in a hot dog stand, a Michelin-starred kitchen, and a wall of cookbooks. But as he and curator Elizabeth Nosek began assembling the museum's new exhibit, Boulder Eats, Food Traditions Along the Front Range, he realized that Boulder's history might be best understood through the meals we remember. Boulder Eats, Food Traditions Along the Front Range is a sprawling new exhibition that runs through July 26, 2026, tracing Boulder's food story from the 1890s Boulder sanatorium scene to the rise of organic supermarkets, backyard gardens, and nearly 200 locally loved restaurants. Featuring more than 300 objects from the museum's permanent collection, the show tells the story of immigrant kitchens, co-op grocery stores, natural food startups, and the kinds of dining spaces, family-owned and white tablecloth or long gone, that helped shape the way that Boulder eats. What I love about this show is that food opens up so many histories, Taylor said. Immigration, family restaurants, grocery stores, outdoor culture, nutrition. There are so many angles, and food is just one of the ways you get to know a town. One side of the gallery is historical, showcasing early kitchen technology, the Boulder Sanitarium's whole grain dietary experiments, and the founding of grocery stores such as Ideal Market. The other focuses on restaurants and features a dense visual archive of neon signs, menus, uniforms, and more than 175 Boulder eateries, past and present. We all have those favorite restaurants that are now gone. Matam Fez, with its legendary honey almond chicken and belly dancers, which closed in 2006. The Med, which didn't reopen after the onset of the pandemic, and arguably had the best bacon-wrapped dates. I'm still in mourning over the loss of Boss Lady Pizza on the Hill, which shut down in 2022, even though a location still exists in Superior. During opening weekend, Taylor said almost every visitor stopped by to point out a place that they had seen, worked, or remembered. It was like a walk down memory lane, he said. People were geeking out over the food and all of the memories. The exhibition draws on more than 300 artifacts from the museum's permanent collection, spanning everything from antique kitchen tools and 1970s co-op grocery posters to handwritten recipes, locally printed cookbooks, and chef jackets donated by some of Boulder's most recognizable names. There are nods to early natural food pioneers such as Celestial Seasonings, the tea company founded in Boulder in 1969, and White Wave, the parent company behind Silk Soy Milk and other plant-based products that helped launch the national organic movement. Displays also highlight community space such as farmers markets, home gardens, and family-owned diners that shaped everyday life. Together, they create an edible timeline that's made up of half archive, half neighborhood scrapbook. The exhibit does not end at the gallery walls, though. A full slate of programming stretches through next summer, turning Boulder Eats into something closer to a living archive, hands-on, family-friendly, and occasionally spiked with hard cider. Visitors can sign up for guided food history tours with long-time food local writer John Lendorf. Decorate snowman cookies with Lucky's Bakehouse or get their hands in the dirt during a spring garden night with Growing Gardens in Slow Food Boulder County. There is something for everybody, Taylor said. Kids decorating cookies, adults coming in for cider. It's not just about looking at things behind glass. It's about getting into the story. The events also dive deeper into Boulder's more complex food legacies. A panel on the history of the Boulder County Farmers Markets, a workshop with immigrant chefs from Cucina Libre, and a February program with the Beer Culture Center, which will explore how 19th century German brewers and Chicago temperance colonists clashed over beer laws in early Boulder County. Nosek, who had dreamed of creating a food-focused show for years, designed Boulder Eats to be an open table, one that brings together stories that have long existed in parallel. Seventh-day Adventists serving whole grains at the Boulder Sanatorium in 1896. Immigrant-owned restaurants introducing new flavors and natural food entrepreneurs building billion-dollar brands from buckets of tofu. The show spotlights restaurant workers, farmers, grocers, lunchroom reformers, and home cooks. It includes voices that shaped Boulder's food culture, which haven't always been included in how the city tells its story. Just like we've done with exhibits like Voices, Viva, and Bending the Arc, this one centers people, Taylor said. People who cooked and grew and served and nourished the community. That's what food is. Food is identity. Rachel Cara Luzzi and Jessica Benjamin of Savor Productions, the team behind First Bite, Boulder's first but now defunct annual restaurant week, didn't set out to become museum curators. But when the Museum of Boulder came calling, they answered. The pair had previously worked with the museum on the Sink's 100th anniversary celebration and soon found themselves tapped to help bring a sprawling new exhibition about Boulder's food scene to life. Nozick told us that one of her career goals was to someday create a food-based exhibit, Kalazuzzi said. She said, if this ever comes to fruition, I am going to give you a call. And that call came last year. Savor was brought on to curate the dining out portion of the exhibit, working closely with longtime food writer and historian John Lendorf to sift through Boulder's nearly bottomless restaurant lore. The three of us would sit together and think about the 8 gazillion restaurants that Boulder's had, Kalazuzzi said. Some of the major themes just kept coming up. Those themes include how restaurants have built community in Boulder, how dining culture has shaped the city's identity, and how Boulder's food scene has evolved into a nationally recognized force. Boulder's dining scene has gained national acclaim in recent years, with several local restaurants featured in the 2025 Michelin Guide and Frasca's Food and Wine earning both a Michelin star and a James Beard Award. The city has long drawn culinary attention from a Top Chef spotlight to Bon Appetit, dubbing it America's foodiest town. People actually come to Boulder specifically to dine out, Caraluzzi said. After years of collaborating with current Boulder restaurants, curating history gave Caraluzzi a fuller picture of the city's dining culture. The entire project added such depth to the history that we already knew, Caraluzzi said. It brought even more to the forefront of how Jessica and I want to continue to put a big speaker up to our restaurant industry and connect diners to them. If you're planning to go, Boulder Eats serves up the city's history one bite at a time. The Museum of Boulder is located at 2205 Broadway, and it's open from 9 a.m. until 5 p.m. Wednesdays through Mondays. Is closed on Tuesdays. Admission is $8 to $10. Find out more at www.museumofboulder.org. And now we turn to news from Gun Barrel and NIWAT by reading articles from the Left Hand Valley Courier. Hannah's Herb Shop begins new chapter in NIWAT. Hannah's Herb Shop, a longtime natural medicine store originally based in Boulder, has relocated to NIWAT's Cottonwood Square, taking over the retail space formerly occupied by the Little Shop. The store opened its doors to walk-in customers on Monday, November 10th. The business credits itself as one of the nation's first health food stores and was founded by German immigrant Hannah Kruger in 1957. Kruger, along with her husband and children, settled in Boulder in the early 1950s, and throughout her lifetime, she specialized in natural healing methods until her death in 1998. The store's website describes Kruger as unconventional, accomplished in the field of healthcare, and a recognized worldwide master healer. The very first store was on Pearl Street, and it was called New Age Foods, said NIWAT store manager Doreen Bishop. Bishop said the herbal shop on Pearl Street sold a lot of Hannah's products, which were made in the store's basement and had a restaurant on the second floor. A lot of people remember that, she said. Bishop said Kruger later moved her operation to Belmont Road, and the store was there for 30 years until recently. Bishop explained why the store moved to NIWAT. The store that we had over in Boulder didn't get a lot of foot traffic, and I know that when we changed managers, that was one thing they were concerned about. Bishop said when the NIWAT space became available, it was one of the locations that management kept looking at and coming back to. And also they love the fact that this town is such a community, added Bishop. Bishop said that the NIWAT shop is also the location for the company's e-commerce site and shipping operation. Since Kroger's death in 1998, Kroger's daughter, Gisela Kroger Hoffman, and grandson, Alberto Kroger, have continued her legacy and run her businesses, including operating Kroger Herb Products, a wholesale company in Longmont. Alberto Kroger explained they moved the wholesale operation to Longmont and consolidated it under one roof because it was all splintered up. Kroger said the wholesale operation is positioned to grow with the popularity of herbal products. He said he worked closely with his grandmother from his teenage years until her passing, particularly in operating Peaceful Meadow Retreat, the Boulder Event Center, noting that he continued running the school with the support of his aunt Gisela. Alberto described his grandmother as amazing and noted, basically, she taught me to tell the truth. Bishop said Kruger's core message was simply to help one another. She was always big on that, on having everybody help each other. So I think that's what we are here for, is to help everybody. The store carries three lines of Hannah products and also provides other brands and herbal supplements and information for those trying to achieve good health and healing through traditional and alternative therapies, including teas and tinctures according to Bishop. As a certified clinical herbalist herself, Bishop remarked, I do know that people nowadays, they really need a place where they can come in and talk to an herbalist. Bishop said that people often come in for the store's detox and parasite cleansing items, which Hannah Kroeger was known for. She said, over the years, those are the ones that kind of stayed around and that seem to be our most popular. Bishop said the store maintains a list of practitioners who are trained using Hannah's products, as well as providing information on the store's website at www.hannaherbshop.com. Why Not Coffee welcomes Jim Falk's Kinetic Art. Why Not Coffee Company has regularly housed and sold some incredibly beautiful pieces of art created by local artists. Why Not currently features a style of kinetic art by Jim Falk. He's a 34-year resident of Niwot. Kinetic art is a style of art that is very similar to sculpture but involves movement. Falk's artistic approach incorporates mechanical elements to create movement and utilizes LED lights, which are safe to touch. He utilizes a low 12-volt power supply generated by UL, Underwriter Laboratories, approved power suppliers. My friend, Laurie Algar, a fellow local artist, facilitates the art shows at Why Not Coffee Shop, said Falk. She thought my art would be a great fit. Laurie and her husband, Randy, helped me set up the displays and place the wall anchors so that customers can have a good view of the works. Falk said the pieces are safe by design and that all motors and current are torque limited. So if someone put their finger in one of the mechanisms, the unit would stall. Additionally, the LED light bulbs are also low voltage and cool to the touch, emitting virtually no heat. For the past 25 years, Falk has been dedicating time to his art. He acquires his eclectic materials from ham radio swap meets, garage sales, eBay, and local art and resource stores. There he finds vintage tin toys, gauges and meters, bulbs, drawers, old fencing, gears, motors, old vacuum tubes, antique fuse boxes and switches, old brass parts, and old erector set parts. Each piece of the kinetic creations that Falk forges can take anywhere from 2 to 3 weeks. When he started in the 90s, he was working and he put his projects on pause, but he has now made a total of over 30 pieces. I took art studio when I was in electrical engineering at the University of South Carolina, said Falk, and at the same time, I worked as a student assistant in the physics department model shop. We were repairing and building lab equipment and hosting a class entitled Physics and the Arts. Falk said that he was impressed by the text that they used by engineer artist Frank Molina called Kinetic Art Theory and Practice. It was then that his interest was sparked and would later turn into a hobby, only enhanced after retirement. Falk worked for the U.S. Navy in Charleston, South Carolina, on nuclear subs as a reactor protection and safety engineer. At that time, he could buy surplus materials in bulk from ships being upgraded. It was a treasure trove of old meters, mechanical parts, and vintage electronics, he said. It was after that when Falk went to graduate school in engineering at the University of South Carolina and was subsequently hired to work at Storage Tech. Then he went to work at ST Microelectronics, followed by Seagate in Longmont, where he retired in 2018. Falk and his family moved to Niwot in 1991. We are never leaving, he said. He's been married to his wife, Kathy, for the past 44 years and has two daughters, Kate and Hillary. My family is an inspiration for my artwork, said Falk. I get tremendous amount of support from them, including tolerating a basement full of hardware and other materials. He accepts commissions and can be contacted directly for any of his existing works at jfalkee@gmail.com. Here is a local obituary for Arlene Marie, her nickname was Tiny, Algrim, born December 27, 1941. She passed away on November 10, 2025. Arlene Marie Tiny Algrim gained her angel wings on November 10th at age 83. Tiny was born on December 27, 1941 in Denver, Colorado, to Edward and Frances Obrecht. At age 4, the family moved to a farm north of Longmont. Tiny attended Mead High School, where she was a cheerleader and participated in choir, graduating in 1960. Tiny met the love of her life, Otto L. Algrim II, in 1955. After a 5-year courtship, Tiny and Otto married on May 26, 1962 in Longmont. She worked a variety of jobs, starting at her aunt's diner. And that was Lutz Drug on Main Street. She was a stay-at-home mom, as well as a school bus driver, clerk at the Longmont Police Department. She also clerked at Hitching Post Cleaners and City of Longmont Parks. What Tiny will be remembered most for are her exquisite and delicious cakes and for her artistic talent, which shone through. For over 30 years, she made most of the wedding cakes in Longmont and throughout Colorado, as well as many birthday, anniversary, graduation, retirement, and all occasion cakes. She purchased a printer, allowing her to put edible photos on cakes. A very nurturing grandmother, she often encouraged the grandchildren to make and decorate their own mini cakes. During her cake days, she worked part-time gigs, including delivering the Left Hand Valley Courier in South Longmont and Niwot for many years. And she also watered the potted flowers in Niwot. Always one for adventure, she owned and drove her own motorcycle. She broke both ankles rollerblading with her grandchildren. She got her first tattoo at age 68, and she ziplined Las Vegas's Fremont Street in her 70s. She even agreed enthusiastically to dress as the Left Hand Valley Courier duck for the annual duck race, and she walked in the holiday parade in Niwot during the 2010s. Tiny was known for her kind and caring ways, also often taking food, flowers, and cards to family, friends, and neighbors. Tiny adored babies, often holding any that she came into contact with. Preceding Tiny in death were her husband Otto, parents Edward and Frances Obrecht, sister Edwina Diekman, brother Edward Obrecht Jr., and nephew Dean Diekman. Survivors include daughter Vicki Maurer and her husband Tony, son Todd Algrim and his wife Sean, grandchildren Alex, Kristen, and her fiancé Matthew Toko, great-granddaughter Betty Wood, sister Marilyn Holzclaw of Bartlesville, Oklahoma, and brother Ronald Obrecht and his wife Tammy of Longmont, as well as many beloved nieces, nephews, and cousins who will miss her presence. The memorial service is held today, Friday, November 21st, 11 a.m. at Messiah Lutheran Church, 1335 Francis Street in Longmont. The family will be available at 10 a.m. prior to the service for visitation. A reception will be held following in the Luther Room of the church after the service. Memorial contributions may be made to Terrell Winds Hospice, 4710 Table Mesa Drive, Unit B, Boulder, Colorado, 80305, or to Messiah Lutheran Church, located at 1335 Francis Street in Longmont, Colorado, 80501. Thank you for joining us for the Boulder Foothill News, read by Leslie Madsen.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.
The content featured in this recording may not reflect the views of AfterSight or the presenter. For questions, concerns, or editorial feedback regarding the Boulder Weekly, contact letters@boulderweekly.com or call 303-494-5511.